Bonjour, bonjour, bonjour. Welcome to the SBS Cycling Podcast. And as usual, I am joined with the biggest and the greatest of them all, Dave McKenzie. This time in English, Mika.
Oh, my goodness me. It's almost getting old, you know.
Is it embarrassing? Like, or
not? Yeah, no, not at all. Take it. I say take it. Take the applause when you can get it, I think, because one day it will stop.
I know. We all know this.
We all know this. So what is it? You're only as big as your last win? Or
exactly, yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah. But yeah. We also know how small a fish pond is.
Yeah,
you know?
Yes. It's good to be here. To be here.
What a week. What a week. Mm. We are celebrating Grace Byrne in this podcast today.
How good.
Amazing. We'll hear about her in a second, but you mentioned a few things we will talk at the back of this interview. But Grace Byrne, just amazing. Just like recap how you lived this finish, because it's a particular moment in women's cycling history.
It is. And, you know, just even the running, the last six kilometres.
The last 5 years with her. But anyway,
yeah,
we talk about it.
Yeah, but no, it's, you know, it was a nail-biting sort of a finish, you know, and especially for Aussie fans. But the podium too speaks
absolutely
volumes of who was below the two steps beside her, you know.
Pretty massive.
It is massive.
Yeah, let's listen from Grace Byrne, an interview I was lucky enough to do straight after a win, actually. The next day after a win, she just woke up and decided to have a chat with us. So that's a very grand of Grace Byrne. I don't know if this interview is exclusive. I don't know if she's spoken to anybody else, but let's claim it. Okay, Grace Byrne.
Grace, thank you for the time you're giving us here on the SBS Cycling Podcast. First of all, a bit of water gone under the bridge, I guess, as we say. Time has passed a bit, but how do you feel after the win over the weekend? What a win. What are your first thoughts when you put yourself back into that final sprint?
Hi, Christoph. Yeah, it's been a crazy day since crossing the line in Liège. And honestly, thinking back, it's still quite hard to believe. I don't think I've quite processed the whole thing yet, like just the whole day out in the break and then finally being there in the sprint and coming past Longo Borghini in the end. It was surreal.
How the sprint went for you, because you were somewhat a bit at the back and then all of a sudden you came from nowhere, and then the pedigree in that sprint was still very good, and at the end you come up on top. How was it from the inside?
So coming into the final straight with 800 metres to go, Cassie Nuadoma had attacked Elisa Longo Borghini, started closing it down with Kim Kadzo. I was conscious not to go too early, so I sat behind Kadzo and just hoped that she would keep riding as hard as she could and keep the gap, you know, within like an attainable distance. And really, I was just thinking, I have to be patient, don't jump and open up the sprint too early. And then once I saw 200 metres to go, I thought, okay, now I have to jump. And I started sprinting basically at the same time as Nuadoma and Longo Borghini, and just managed to get into the slipstream, come with a bit more speed. There was a moment where I sat back down on my saddle and my legs were tired, and I thought maybe I can finish my sprint in the saddle. But then I thought, no, I need to get back up and keep powering to the line. And it was just enough to get my half bike length ahead of Longo Borghini. So, yeah, pretty cool sprint.
When you think about history, you're the first Australian woman to have won a monument. And when we look back at hundreds of years, you know, on the men's side, we're talking Eddy Merckx, 19 monuments, Pogacar actually on the same weekend just before you won his sixth monument. You're the first Australian woman to have won a monument. How does that sit with you in terms of you making history? Because in 5 years' time, in 10 years' time, you're always going to be the first Australian woman winner of a monument.
Yeah, I don't think I ever really thought about the fact that an Australian woman hasn't won a monument yet. And I guess it speaks a little bit to the fact that the women haven't had a chance to compete at the monument races for that long. Like, this was just the eighth edition of Liège-Bastogne-Liège. And, you know, we only just started Paris-Roubaix 3 years ago. Flanders has been on our program a little bit longer. But, yeah, the opportunities for Australian women to win monuments has been not that great. So, yeah, it's special both for the fact that, you know, I've made history, but also for what it signifies that now the opportunities are there to do it. So, yeah, I think that's the main thing, that it's now other Australians can follow in my footsteps and continue to win monuments.
That victory, does this mean for you, you reassess your year? And my point here is, you've said it yourself, you had a quiet start of the year, maybe perhaps not entirely happy with your performance so far, but then does this change totally the vision and the world that you had about your performance over the last few months? And what does that mean for the future? We know you've got a big, massive target in Paris, of course, around the Olympics. Do you get some comfort in knowing your performance is there and you've got that monument under your wing now?
Yeah, I think my goals remain the same for this year. Like, as I think I've stated before now, like the Olympics is my number one goal for the year, especially in the time trial. But having this win after, a slow start, a tough start to the year, like I had quite a bit of self-doubt before yesterday that, you know, maybe I just wasn't good enough anymore. But this past week has shown me that, you know, sometimes the form just comes a little bit later than you plan for. And, yeah, now I have the confidence that I know that I can play at that top level, and those big goals that I have, I can go after. I still have the strength that I've had in the past. So, it gives me excitement for the year ahead that I can really go after those big goals.
You came close a couple of times or several times on actually winning monuments. What does that mean for you as a rider wants to win a monument, but that quest that you had for so many years, do you feel a sense of accomplishment today, or do you just feel that you know you want more and more and more, and that's just a step towards more victories for you, more hunger, because you're sort of suited for that sort of campaign in a monument? So is it something that, yeah, more hunger to get more, or a sense of accomplishment, or maybe just, you know, both?
Yeah, I think my immediate feeling is a sense of accomplishment. And yeah, it was really one of those pipe dream sort of things that, yeah, you know, you want on your Palmar monument win, but it's not an easy thing to attain. And I know I've been close the numerous times, but to actually get the win is a huge thing. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe we'll see once the high of this one wears off. But yeah, at the moment, I feel like, wow, I have that to my name, and that's really cool. But yeah, I mean, I won't say no to more victories like this, of course.
So that was Grace Brown. She's taking the win, very happy to have that win under her belt, of course. How significant it is in history, we talk about it with her. But when I did ask the question, I think she didn't even realize she was the first one in making history.
Yeah.
You're an history man.
I'm
a man of history.
I'm a historical. I'm historical in a cycling sense. So if you just give me a second to explain it, because I think it's really important.
Mm-hmm.
It's how I see the sport, and women. Some women probably don't see it this way, right? So I'm going to say something that could be slightly controversial.
Well, let's go.
And you don't know where I'm going with this. No, so historically, for a long time, women didn't have these monuments, you know, and for a big chunk, as we know, the Tour de France was missing. But so for people like Grace Brown, massive goal for her is Paris Olympics. And for a lot of the women, the Olympics were the bigger goal than just about anything on the cycling calendar, because that actually gave them an opportunity potentially to capitalise some financial gains,
and
I suppose.
We knew that Australia was investing a lot of money, so there's a lot of funding behind. It's not just a medal.
Yeah, but for me, winning Liège Bastogne Liège for Grace Brown to me is bigger than if she wins.
So do you think the game has changed for women's cycling?
No, I don't think
it has yet.
I don't think it has yet. I think it's crossroads. If you're a young, I don't know, someone like Sarah Gigante is still quite young. You know, Sarah Gigante one day hopefully will win Liège and she could win a medal at the Olympics. She probably still sees the Olympics as a bigger thing. But in a real traditionalist sense about cycling, to me, Liège is bigger. Mm-hmm. It's a monument. In 20 years, in 30 years, in 100 years when we're all dead and buried, Grace Brown's name will be there as the first Australian woman to win this monument.
Yeah, absolutely.
That is massive. It is so big.
Yeah, it's huge. And then you mentioned before the interview the podium as well, and we come to the podium in a second. But when you talk about the hierarchy as well, this is very interesting because Flanders was here a long time ago.
Yeah.
But then other monuments came along, and now, you know, in a way, Liège is La Doyenne for the men's.
Yeah.
It's the oldest one-day race ever on the planet.
Yeah.
Cycling, I mean.
Yeah.
So that... The Liège woman is not anywhere close to this. It's only the fourth edition or something like this.
Yeah, they've only had so many.
But still, the importance of that win, significant on the calendar. And now you have a proper classics calendar as well as a Grand Tour calendar for the women's race.
Yeah.
So this is why I'm interested by what you're saying about at what stage does the Olympic become a bit less important, which is the case for the men, let's face
well,
it. It's an important title, but it's less important than the Tour de France, for example.
It's less important. And I think what we're seeing in the women's is it's accelerating faster than what the men's have. The men's has been a longevity, you know, 100 years of history with some of these events, as you say, Liège and Flanders and Roubaix and all those. So they've got the historical aspect. The women don't have that. They've got 4 years, 7 years, I think, for the Flanders maybe, or a bit more, but it's accelerating fast. And in a nice way, they are standing on their own now with their own standalone events, but they are pigging back off the history a little bit of the men's, which is great. I think it's great because...
It's called branding.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the branding of the race.
Yeah, and if they weren't able to piggyback off, you know, Bastogne Liège for the women, it wouldn't have the same ring. If there was no men's Liège, Bastogne Liège, Bastogne Liège for the women wouldn't be as big. It's like Trofeo Alfredo Binda for the women. That is a big one day. Mm-hmm. I think it's World Tour. You know, that is a big... It's sort of like a monument, I guess, for the women. But it doesn't carry the same weight as these races.
You've got a very good point here because the Giro was in that same case as well, where they didn't back them up as the women's version of the Giro. Then he didn't have the aura that he probably has now.
Yeah.
And so the game has changed and is still changing in that space.
And it's accelerating. Yeah.
So from here, Grace Brown, fantastic
queue in the rack. Put the queue in the rack.
Yeah.
Grace,
is that what you say? One for the pool room?
No, I mean, it's, you know, we joke about it. But again, we cannot... I think we've already said it, the significance of the victory, and she's finished second, remember, behind Lizzie Dynan a few years ago.
Twice,
has she? Jesus, I've missed that one.
Yeah,
Amanda Spratt's finished on the podium, I think, as well.
Quick shout out to Spratty, actually, because amazing as she is, she put a comment on one of my Facebook Instagram posts where she says, I can't wait to listen to that story.
One legend
wanting to listen to another legend story.
I
love this.
There's some real great camaraderie, I think, amongst the Aussies. And Sarah Gigante as well talked about her own race, and we'll talk a bit more about her in a moment. But she also mentioned... But how cool to see another Aussie win. You know, she was... Mm-hmm. So they're all supportive of each other, which I think is great. And, you know, your enemy's on the bike.
Yeah, of course.
100%, but off the bike, they've got each other's back, which is cool.
Did you have lots of frenemies like this in a peloton?
Yeah, the Aussies, I mean, there was few and far between in my era, and obviously the era before me was less. So you seeked them out so you could talk your best Australian jargon.
Like proper English.
Yeah, and it was generally at the start of the race. If it was initially, you know, there was a lot more piano sessions, so you could maybe have an hour of gas bagging.
Yeah.
Matt White, he was always up for a good gas bag.
You mentioned the podium as well, and before we move to the men's version of the Liège, Bastogne Liège, but that podium. Fantastical. Mm. But the fact that she was able to beat who she beat in this finish on a sprint, and she knew she was probably fast enough, maybe even the fastest.
Yeah.
But still, the pedigree, there's some serious race winners with
her. Well, and you know what I loved about it, too? Like the whole thing where she nearly endoed, nearly came off 6-7 kilometres out. She had to chase for a few kilometres to get back. She gets back. They were all on their hands and knees. So it was a classic monument finish. You know, Longo Borghini actually had two lengths on Grace when they kicked, but they were all sort of on their hands and knees. New Adoma had attacked. I think there was another rider had attacked prior to that. Vollering was at the back, and all the commentators were talking, Vollering, waiting, because she's such a star. Vollering had no juice at the end. So they were all on their hands and knees, and in the end, it was a little bit a la Matthew Heyman, you know. Nothing was going to stop her. Nothing was going to stop her from winning. You know, even an almost crash, you know, having to chase back. It didn't matter what was going to happen to her. She actually was always going to nail it. So she totally proved outright that she was the stronger rider on the day.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about the men's version of La Doyenne. So we said earlier on the oldest race around Liège-Bastogne-Liège. Bridie said it's so good you have to go twice or to tell the name twice. Liège is not that good, by the way.
Yeah. Especially in winter, and especially on Sunday, it was pretty rough. Yeah, the weather was pretty average.
That's just me being French and stuff. But Liège is not that great. But anyway, it's a great race. And a winner, Tadej Pogacar. I mean, that would raise a couple of questions around this in a second, but predictable, predicted, and delivered. Clinical. And
yeah,
The attack was textbook.
Yeah, it was textbook. The only, you know, element probably prior to that, we went, can Van der Poel match him?
Yeah.
And in the end, obviously, he couldn't. He was, you know, what's wrong with him, Van der Poel? I mean, seriously.
Well,
he wins Flanders. He wins. What else did he win? Like, come on, mate. Recover. Yeah. He had 4 or 5 days to recover. But, he didn't even ride flesh.
Yeah, Jesus. But the thing is, like, he didn't try and he's still on the podium. At some point, he was way back, though.
Yeah, he was. He obviously, look, monuments, and when you've got three close together, Flanders, Roubaix, and obviously he went deep in those, even though he won comfortably, he went really deep. They take it out of you. And you've got three that are close together. So he and Liège is a different kettle of fish. We know that. The amount of climbing, it's like a mountain stage in terms of the climbing of the Tour de France or the Giro. So there was always that question mark, but to still finish third.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah, you go, yeah, the guy's a freak.
Yeah, he's absolutely. Before we talk about Pogacar, and stay tuned if you want to join that chat about Pogacar or analyze what we are saying about it. A certain Romain Bardet is second at Liège-Bastogne.
And what about the emotion?
Yeah, but his best ever result in a monument.
Yeah.
This is coming on within weeks or days of the Giro.
Yeah.
He is at the Giro. He's targeting a good performance at the Giro. Clearly, he's got form. But the way he's done it as well, where the group was coming back to him and then they started to look at each other, he really took his chance. Talk about Matt Heyman as well earlier on. Typically Matt Heyman moment as well, where he just kept on it.
He's a racer.
You never know.
Yeah.
And that's a proven in the proof in the pudding, you never know.
Yeah.
You never know. If the group is coming back, at some point they decided to look at each other and not riding. And the fact that Van der Poel came back changed the game. And Bardet was in control of nothing that has happened behind him. He just kept at it with one motion going forward.
He's one of that original new generation riders. You know, he's been a pro for a long time now.
But so not necessarily looking at the watts, not calculating.
Yeah,
just
exactly. He's a racer. He's, you know, and he'll put himself to the sword with the prospect of potentially winning, you know, and that's what he did. And it paid off. He didn't win. He came second. But that's what I think we've grown to love about the likes of Bardet. And, you know, they're pre-Mathieu Van der Poel.
Yeah.
They're pre, you know, he's probably that ilk of Alaphilippe, you know, they're the similar era, I suppose. So, but no, it is. It's cool. But I loved his emotion at the end, you know. And he crashed out, didn't he, last year?
Mm-hmm.
So there's all that talk about that. So you realise how much this plays on their mind and how much they want it. You know, you think Bardet is like, I'm towards the end of my career. I've had possibly my best Tour de France finish. You know,
twice on the podium, 1 second at the World Championship.
Yeah.
You know, like silver medal.
The best potentially is behind him, and the best is pretty damn good.
Yeah.
You know, if he retired tomorrow, he will go down as one of the greats of our sport. But how much he still wants it and how much he still has that real raw passion. And that's, gee, I love that. I really love that.
Totally agree.
At the end of the day, they're just bike riders.
Mm, totally agree. Now, let's talk about Tadej. Before 2020, before Roglic, Slovenia has never won a monument.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know how many it is for overall. I think it's eight monuments, but six of them.
Country of 3 million people.
Eight monuments, six of them are Tadej Pogacar. And as much as I love the guy and I love the way he's racing and it's exciting, I'm going to put a question out there. Is it really exciting or is it making the race a little bit boring in a sense that, I mean, let's be controversial, but in a sense that the guy is saying what he's doing.
Yeah.
He's basically in the morning, he's not even warning people off. He's saying to the media, 34 kilometers, I think I'm going to go. He's going on the dot 34 kilometers.
Yeah, he's telling them.
And I did a bit of research. When he attacks like this, within the first 10 kilometers, he gains a minute every time. And he did
So he puts them to the sword early, or at least.
So when he attacks far away from 50K or 40K or 30K like this, within the first 10 kilometers of that attack, he always claims a minute. And then after that, he controls. This is what he's doing.
Then he settles into his rhythm. Yeah,
absolutely. But should, like, I don't know, I'm not a rider and I'm not an ex-rider, but people know that now. I'm not just the only plonker that can actually read the statistics.
Mate, I just think you should shut up and, you know, enjoy the exploits of...
No, look. Do you see what I mean? Like,
It's true. I mean, it's getting to the point, you know what will be the funny one? When he hands out a script to the other teams of how he's going to win, but and they still can't do anything about it.
Technically, he does.
He sort of does. He broadcasts it around the world on live TV before the start. I think it was it Strada Bianca?
Exam.
And that's not the first he did it, but that was the one I thought was actually funny after the race because they said, you know, can you give us an idea of when you will attack? Oh, no, I will attack at kilometre 80.
And he did.
Exactly. But you know what? It was reverse psychology, I think, because all the other teams went, yeah, of course he won't. It's 80 kilometres to go. What sort of an idiot would do that? Sure enough, he did it.
So, okay, it's exciting for that moment where he attacks, you go, oh, okay.
And the race is alive. And then for 2 minutes later, or what did you say? 10 kilometres later, it's like...
It's done. And then it's packed.
Now, I think, look, every can I, it's probably not the right expression, but every dog has their day. So someone, and like Mathieu van der Poel, these athletes that are at extreme sort of level at the moment and against, you know, the world's best. But remember that stage? There was a stage in the Giro, I think it was during COVID. I can't remember the exact year, but I think it was Tirreno Adriatico. So I'm going to a different race here. It was pretty average conditions. Van der Poel attacked like 70 Ks to go. And he had minutes. No one could get near him. And 20 K to go, he exploded.
Mm-hmm.
He still won the stage and Pogacar was hunting him down big time. And in the end, Pog was about 20 seconds behind or 30 seconds behind. Van der Poel still won, but he showed his vulnerability and he showed how deep he went. So guys like Pog, this will happen.
Well, are you sure? In a way, and let's I'll be the devil's let's be the devil's advocate. But Pogacar has never ever shown any sign of this. Where you're right, Vanderpool did it.
He cracked at the Tour two years ago. Remember?
Did he crack?
No,
he
completely cracked.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that? I think you were at the base of the climb. Okay. We had to park up at the base. Hot day. Stinking hot day.
So he got the nutrition wrong.
And
allegedly.
Whatever. He got it wrong. But remember, Vingegaard, that was where he won the Tour. He lost three minutes completely. So there is that element you go, this can happen. But I do understand what you're saying. He's broadcasting when he's going to attack, when he's going to win. And I think on a one-day event, because it's not that accumulative fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
So the Grand Tours are different. So for him, I think the trick is managing his effort in the Grand Tours. I think
gain more maturity in that controlling of the race.
And let's face it, the stars, and not in a great way, but the stars are quasi aligning for the Pog to do the double this year in the Giro and the Tour. Because Vingegaard, you know, he's collapsed lung, he's gone a big long road of rehab.
And for the people that are new to cycling, let's explain that this is absolutely phenomenal if it happens. The last time he did was 1998, not even this millennium.
Yeah.
And he was Pantani
Marco
doing
Pantani,
it. Mario Pantani. That's never been done before.
Yeah.
And I think he only been done a couple of times in a history, and the Giro was not even at the same place in the calendar.
Yeah.
So doing it now in 2024 or in this modern era would be enormous.
It would be massive.
No matter who is here or who's not.
And even just to go on the Pantani one for a second, that was fascinating because he won the Giro, right? And then I reckon he partied hard for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Didn't ride his bike too much. And then they said, let's just start the tour. Let's go to the tour.
Yeah, let's see how he goes.
First week, it was classic sort of tour. You could sort of sit on the back. He did. I think he lost a little bit of time, but not much. There was one day. Jan Ulrich was the defending champ, I think. So Ulrich was back to win again. Mm-hmm. And everyone was talking about Ulrich winning 3 or 5 tours. You know, he was the young gun. One day in the Alps, it was atrocious conditions. And Pantani pulled 6 minutes on Ulrich. And that was where he won the tour.
Mm-hmm.
It was unbelievable. It was the worst conditions. I think they finished on Duzelp, and Pantani just blew everyone to pieces. Mm-hmm. And Ulrich just could not handle the cold.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, it was this stars aligned for Pantani. It was amazing.
Yeah.
So you're right. And even to do it now, 26 years later or whatever, would be as phenomenal.
Yeah.
I think even though it is the POG.
Yeah. Absolutely.
He will go deep somewhere at the Giro, I'm pretty sure.
And no doubt all of us would be in awe about this if it happens. But in terms of how he is as well at the minute, he's not racing much part of the year. He's selecting his one-day races.
Yep.
The number of numbers on his back or pinned down on his back this year is very low. But he's performed pretty much at almost all of them.
I could be wrong, but I presume he probably won't race now till the Giro.
Yeah,
I mean,
okay.
it's in, we're a week and a half away.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I imagine he'll rest up.
Calm down.
because the other races have started and we might touch on them in a second.
Yeah.
But Tour of Turkey, Romandy, they're already underway. So we know he's not doing those. So, it's going to be either way, we know the Giro is incredible as a race in itself.
Actually, because we can talk about the Giro is, we are on the doorstep of the Giro, okay? With the way the cookie crumbled this year, a lot of the riders were targeting the Tour de France, then Tour de Pays Basque happened, there's been crashes, there's been elements of riders dropping out or being sick, some have been, Quintana has had a problem with his Achilles heel, a lot of riders have been sort of impacted by health. But therefore, the Giro looks, on paper, amazing.
Yeah.
And what's going to happen here at the Giro?
But it's every year, isn't it? You're absolutely right. But the reality, I mean, that Pays Basque crash, Jay Vine obviously involved in a lot of the big stars. But it also means the Vuelta is going to be huge.
I know.
Because some of those riders won't be quite right at the Tour or for the Tour. Therefore, they won't do it. So the big objective will be the Vuelta. The Giro capitalizes as well.
So someone like Vingegaard, let's just divert a sec, but someone like Vingegaard, if he's not 100% and ready to win the Tour de France...
Oh, he'll go to the Vuelta.
Should he bypass the Tour de France or take it as a training ride, a recovery sort of thing, and really target the Vuelta that he, let's remember, really wanted to win last year and didn't.
I know. that's right. I think there'll be this really tough decision for them to make.
Mm-hmm.
I think they'll make the call and say...
Relatively early, do you think?
Well, they'll leave it up until the last 2 weeks, I think, of the tour, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But they'll make a decision if Vingegaard is back to his best and he can really challenge for the tour. And if he can't, if they don't think he's at his best and he doesn't think so, I don't think they'll put him in just to ride around because he's the defending champ, the last two times. He doesn't want to go there and ride around. He wants to go there and win. So natural instinct, he'll want to race hard. So I think they'll either say, no, let's pull the pin on it. Let's give the spot to someone else. And they've still got a great team.
Yeah.
We know they've still got fantastic riders on that squad that can do something, maybe not win the race, but do something.
So in that sense,
own, right?
If that happens, would you go with Sepkus or Jorgensen?
I think you'd go with Kuss.
with Chris?
I think because he's now got the experience. Well, he's already got more experience, hasn't mm-hmm. he? He's a seasoned pro, but he's got the experience of winning a Grand Tour.
Yeah.
He's got the experience of being the last guy there for Vingegaard
and defending
and Roglic,
defending the lead.
He'll handle the pressure,
yeah.
I think, a bit better, I suppose. But the young guys handle it. The young guys and girls handle it.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. No, we seem to think they can't, but they absolutely mm-hmm. can. Okay. But I'd still go with Kuss, and you go with Jorgensen as a plan B.
Yeah,
so and they are the two riders that will possibly, help that decision for Vingegaard or for the team. If Vingegaard's 90%, they'll say, "Well, geez, we've got Sepp Kuss.
Yeah,
you know, we can back him in. He can potentially win the tour."
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But if Vingegaard's there, it's going to cause some disruption. You know, it's just going to cause – it's going to make the job harder for management,
isn't it,
to make the calls on the road.
The more I think of it, the more I think they're going to make the call that Vingegaard is not going to go.
Yeah.
Because when you look at the health concern and everything –
I say they might make it 2 weeks out. They might make it 4 weeks out because then they can absolutely say – you're going to the Vuelta, and he can,
focus on it,
"Okay, I don't have to be good for July. I'm
look, I know nothing. I know absolutely nothing in this world of cycling.
Don't be too harsh on yourself. Yeah. You're still learning, but you're pretty good.
I'm still very green. I would say here, I don't think it would be here, but let's see if I'm right or not. One last thing I wanted to talk about is how good are you in predicting riders and so on? Bernal, you saw that Bernal was getting back up.
Yep.
Getting, how good was he in Liège? He's done very well. The performance, maybe not on the finish line, but he's back.
He's there.
Bernal is there. He's back.
And Liège is a tough day, as you know. But it was, the weather was pretty tough. So to perform well in pretty average cold conditions, I'm gunning for him.
Yeah.
I'm really gunning for him. I so want to see him. And I think each race he does now, he should be gaining confidence. And I think Ineos would be gaining more and more confidence in him. Yeah, it's so good to see.
Absolutely.
And, cast your minds back to when he won in Ting, is it?
No, I'm not.
No, he didn't win, sorry. But the stage was cut short.
I am not casting my mind back there. Thank you very much.
Why not?
Alaphilippe wrote the yellow jersey on that day. On the ultra,
he's never going to win it. Come on,
you were starting to sweat a bit. You had your house on the line.
I did. My Spanish house was on the line. Oh, that's right.
You were starting to sweat a bit.
I rang Christian. I had him on the hotline. ASO, and I said, "Mate, cause a snowstorm."
Yeah, release the snowstorm.
Something.
Release it. Anyway, to conclude this podcast, let's talk ahead as well about what's happening. So we said the Giro is coming. Before this, there are Tour of Turkey. It's on SBS. There's Tour of Romandy as well.
Yeah, and just quickly, Cam Scott, second in the prologue at Romandy by 1 second for Bahrain Victorious. Yeah. So it was a really short prologue. It was less than 3 minutes.
Alaphilippe?
He was third.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, so Cam Scott, Alaphilippe was eating his dust. So Romandy, and historically, it was always a big build-up race to the Giro.
You've done Romandy?
Yeah, I have. So it's not so much these days, but it is still a big tour. Vuelta Femenina.
Absolutely.
Gets underway this weekend.
On SBS in Valencia.
In Valencia.
We love Valencia.
Slightly, you're a bit homesick?
I'm slightly biased about Valencia a little bit.
It's 8 stages, so it's increased. At the moment, start lists haven't been fully confirmed, but I've seen Sarah Gigante off a great ride at Liège. We didn't talk just in depth about it. Big, long solo break. So Sarah's on the start list. Georgie Howe. And I think Georgia Baker is also there amongst hopefully a few more Aussies. And this weekend, homegrown, we've got to start pumping up the NRS. And, of course, we can't wait for the new league to start. But the Grafton to Inverell, which was always regarded, I would say, as second biggest race, one-day race on the Aussie calendar behind Melbourne and Warrnambool. Grafton Inverell, 228 kilometres with the famous Gibraltar Range, 3,000, almost 400 metres of climb.
Oof, okay.
Yeah, it's a classic. I'd love you to go to it one day, actually. It is a beautiful bike race. So that's this weekend, men's and women's. And our Mexican superstar, Isaac Del Toro Romero. Remember him? He debuted at Tour Down Under in the World Tour. He won a stage there. He was super, and he's so exciting to watch. He has just re-signed with UAE, until 2029.
This is crazy.
That's a bigger contract than SBS has with ASO. Like, I didn't pretty think much, that was possible. 2029.
Yeah.
That's huge.
It's huge. And are they already predicting the post-Pogacar? Or are they...
Well, they're planning, aren't they?
They're planning.
I mean, we know they've got the money. They signed Pog, a year ago, 2 years ago, for 5 years.
Yeah, 5 years.
Mm. As you would. Mm-hmm. But it was, apparently rumoured astronomical figure of 30 million euros over 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say that's about 50 million Australian.
Yeah.
5 years for the best bike rider in the world. Yeah. So Del Toro, Romero, I'd love to know his figure.
Yeah.
It'd have to be over a million per year. Have to be.
But it's a big commitment for them, 2029. Mm. Like it's
massive.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you, Maka.
Thank you very much.